Hello, everyone. Okay, so we'll be starting the afternoon's festivities. So first up this afternoon, we've had this a few years, a kind of a panel. And this is going to be an informal panel discussion. For our panelists, we have Carol Beam from Stanford NCBO. We have Tim Finan, UMBC, one of our symposium co-chairs. We have Frank Olkin from NSF, Mark Fox from Toronto, and Ashit Talukdar from NIST, and he's just parking his car, but we'll start, and he'll be able to join us shortly. So what we're going to be doing for the panel is it's going to be a little kind of a nice, relaxed panel. We've assembled a few questions for the panelists to have meditated upon over the past few days. And the way we'll start off is each panelist will have 5 minutes or so just to give their thoughts off the top of their head on anything relevant to the this year's theme of Semantic Web and Big Data Meets Applied Ontology. So we'll have a round of those thoughts. And then what we'll do is we'll go through, we have about 5 or so questions that we've kind of prearranged, and we'll go through those at each panel, so have an opportunity to respond and give their thoughts on that particular question. And then for each question, what we'll do is after the panel has gone through, we'll open it up to the audience, and if they want to ask any other questions to the panelists related to that question, maybe some clarification, or they said something so controversial, we can take a few moments for that. And after we go through all the questions and there's remaining time, then we'll just open it up to random questions from the audience, both physically and present on the chat. So I guess we could begin. Let's see which way side we want to begin on. Tim, we're going to start.
Oh, well, good afternoon. My name is Tim Finan. I'm from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And I thought I'd start by saying, I consider myself an AI person. I've always been an AI person. And when I got started many years ago, my interest was in language processing and then knowledge representation and reasoning for that. I think during the 80s and some of the 90s, I was really kind of interested in more in knowledge representation and reasoning. But today, my interest is, I think, more focused and driven by applications of where I can, use semantic web technology, and less so by, the basic knowledge representation and reasoning issues. So I guess when I think of ontologies, I usually think of applied ontologies in support of a particular application. And as my answers to the questions will probably show, right now there's sort of 2 application areas that are driving my own interest, but I think they're important application areas, so I'll mention them a little bit. One is using semantic web technology, and my involvement in ontologies today is completely wrapped around semantic web technologies as a in support of information extraction for language. So, finding information in natural language that sort of fits some ontology you're using and then populating that ontology with instance data about, facts that the text asserts. But also using that information that's represented in the instances in the ontology to help further interpret more language. I've been working with a group at the Hopkins, Johns Hopkins Human Language Technology Center of Excellence in the last few years, working on a couple of NIST-related, NIST-supported projects in the text analysis conference track, mainly Cold Start. I'm the designated semantic web or knowledge representation person on the team and been able to find lots of good uses for the technology there for you know, a way to make the ontology that they have defined on paper anyway, concrete, that you can query via Sparkle, the instance data that, you know, you can draw inferences on to sort of enrich the knowledge base. The second application area that's been driving us is cybersecurity. So in some sense, over the years, I've always just focused on, you know, where the money is. And today, there's a lot of money in cybersecurity. It's a rich, you know, a target-rich opportunity for all of us, I guess, no matter, you know, how we approach computer science. And the way we're trying to use it in some of our projects at UMBC is we're trying to use semantic web technology as the way to integrate information from multiple levels in a cybersecurity kind of environment. So you might get information from on possible attacks or intrusion detection from the network level, and you might get it from the host level. And you might also, we're also trying to mine it from text, text that might describe software vulnerabilities in the NIST NVD database, for example, or text of people talking about the vulnerabilities that haven't made it through those kind of more structured sources like the CERT or NVD database. Now, what are people talking about in chat rooms that, or in the newspaper? You know, like just over the weekend, there were announcements that Internet Explorer had a new major flaw that was discovered, and everybody should stop using it immediately. And, you know, that stuff often takes a couple of days or a week before it comes through the more structured channels. So we want to be able to mine facts from that and put it in the same integrated environment that all this information can be put in, and hopefully then can kind of get a better context of what's happening. So for me, I guess what fellow from DARPA said resonated with me, that, you know, start with the problem, whether it's cybersecurity or language understanding, and find out how ontologies and semantic web technology, for me in particular, can help.
Hi, I'm Mark Fox from the University of Toronto. This is my first ontology summit that I have attended. I feel like a newbie here, and but they stuck me at the front of the panel. I only prepared responses to the questions, not knowing that I'd have to start off with an opening remark. So I'll do what Tim did to make my life easier and just tell you why some people think I know something about ontologies. I'm also an AI person like Tim. Tim and I go way back. There are some other people here that I go way back.
More than
10
years.
More than 10 years. when I started off my career back in the late 70s, the very first ontology, we didn't call it that back then, I created, was to represent distributed organizations. And I was looking at that time, how you can take theories of organization theory and economic team decision theory and use that to represent distributed organizations and distributed software and stuff like that, and created a fairly sophisticated ontology at that particular time, akin to a level of what an OWL ontology would look like today. And then I got driven by the same problems that Tim was being driven in. I was working in the manufacturing world for a couple of decades. I was at CMU from 75 to 91. And when we started the Robotics Institute in 1979, 1980, I headed the Intelligent Systems Lab in the Robotics Institute. And my responsibility was white-collar robotics, and which meant AI thinking, et cetera. And we were looking at manufacturing with Westinghouse, et cetera. And at that time, I really had two dual roles. One was to I decided to develop theories of constraint-directed reasoning to do scheduling of factories, and also to develop ontologies for representing manufacturing knowledge. And so it was sort of a dual publication path for much of what I did in the 1980s was how to do constraint-directed scheduling and also how to represent knowledge in manufacturing and logistics and other things. And out of that, we started one of the big four AI companies, Carnegie Group, which was written up a lot in the 1980s. And we did a lot of work with the Department of Defense and built logistics systems for them and with industry and all sorts of stuff. And then I'm skipping over a whole bunch of stuff. But in the early 1990s, I returned to Toronto for personal reasons and began to really focus on ontologies even more so than I had in the past, and came up in 1992 with this idea that that if you're going to evaluate whether an ontology is useful, that you need this notion of a Comte question. And so identified a number of characteristics of an ontology that ontology should be satisfied, including competency. And then Michael and I, where's Mike? Where'd he go to?
Over here.
Michael and I think, wrote this this very interesting paper on what the methodology is for using competency questions to characterize, evaluate, et cetera, ontologies. And it was nice. Was it Anita?
Andrea,
sorry. It was nice to hear Andrea talk about competency questions earlier. And it turns out that what we wrote in 95 included the transformation of informal competency into formal competency and using that to evaluate and retrieve things. And so it's probably worthwhile taking a look at that that paper. So, but most of the time I spent in the 90s with respect to ontology was focusing on ontologies for characterizing human organizations, enterprises. And so that spanned resources, activities, cost, quality, process, organization structure. And so there's a whole bunch of papers back then that take the more formal approach. That is, we axiomatized everything in first order logic when we define an ontology. And so I tend to refer to that as a Toronto school of ontology building, which is to do the formal axiomatization. During that time, I took off and started an e-commerce company in 1993 that did online retailing and took some time off from the university, but still did ontology work in trust and provenance and validity and stuff like that. But now I'm back. And so the reason why I'm here at the summit is I'm actually back full-time in university and focusing all my attention on a new area for me, which is cities, smart cities, and in particular looking at the whole issue of how you represent city knowledge and working in a number of areas of characterizing, representing 311 knowledge, 211 knowledge, and more particular global city indicators, which is now an ISO standard. How do we represent and reason about ways of measuring city performance? And there's other areas I'm doing, but everything I'm doing now is basically ontologies as it relates to cities, and I guess that's why I'm here. So if I say anything in answer to the questions that were posed, it's all going to be in the context of my experiences in the city area as opposed to other areas.
Okay. Good afternoon. I am Carol Bean. I would jokingly, perhaps, hopefully jokingly, say I'm second choice here. I think the preference would have been to have Mark Musen here representing the National Center for Biomedical Ontology, and Mark Musen is, of course, a well-known, well-established, I would say even luminary in the field, equivalent or comparable to many of the luminaries that I'm delighted to be around right now. This is my first ontology summit activity. And I'm finding it one of the more thrilling aspects is to actually see and meet some of the people, A, that I've been hearing and reading the comments from for the past 4 months, but also in some cases for the past 20 years. And, you know, that's always a real treat. My own background is in cognitive science. I've done a lot of work in lexical semantics and primary interest in semantic relationships, you know, went to the dark side for many years, worked for the government, did some of the early work on UMLS, doing program work, but over the past 7 years have been really working on the design and deploy of very large operational systems for certifying EHR, electronic health record technologies. Amazingly, many of the aspects that we need to use for technical requirements and conformance assessment employ the principles of the kind of work that we do here. recently left the government to got an offer I couldn't refuse from Stanford, but would say that, so in many ways I'm going back to my intellectual roots, but in many ways the things that I've always done have been very pragmatic on the one hand, very focused on something real that we can use and operationalize, and also things that happen at the intersection of disciplines. And whether you would call that transdisciplinary or interdisciplinary, I don't really care. It's probably both. But knowledge structures and ontologies are probably the best way really to address issues and questions that fall in those blurry but fairly narrow range. My own training is in classical categorization, controlled vocabularies, terminologies, classification systems, thesauri, et cetera, now sort of subsumed broadly in the ontology world. So I was going to give a brief introduction of the NCBO. I think most people are familiar with the NCBO, so I can probably skip that. For this piece of the panel, I'd be happy to tell anybody later to direct you to our website. Just suffice it to say that the National Center for Biomedical Ontology intends to and does support biomedical researchers in the tasks that they have that are extremely knowledge intensive in this sort of work, by way of online tools, web portals that allow them to access, review, and integrate various resources, particularly the disparate ontological resources. Major focus so far has been primarily on laboratory experiments. Another full circle that I've come around is I was the original program officer for the NCBO when it was first funded by NIH, and so I guess they thought that I would be a good person to come in at the last stage to do a full-blown evaluation and hopefully plan for some of the transitions into some of the more sustainable models that don't require the constant infusion of taxpayer dollars. Just a brief update on the things that NCBO has done in the past year. We've done a complete total soup to nuts, new back-end infrastructure design and deployment. It's got a new API. We've redeveloped based on the new back-end, a new annotator, and are currently working on a new resource index tool. That will come probably sometime this summer and be ready for deployment and use in the fall. Relative to the summit thing, here of ontology in the context of big data and semantic web, I'd like to briefly describe our vision for a new center that we have proposed, and the Center for Expanded Data Annotation and Retrieval, or CEDAR. Everybody likes a nice acronym. So in essence, given the rate, the amount, the complexity, the three V's that we often talk about at which data are currently generated, we feel that there is an absolute urgent need to understand the structure of the data sets, and the conditions under which these data are produced. In other words, we believe that the ultimate big data challenge lies not in the data per se, but in the metadata. And there's been a lot of activity in the metadata area, and I would even say a groundswell of activity, efforts to develop metadata standards, metadata templates, but we still see a lot of barriers remaining to both the development and use of metadata. The problems that the barriers pose are both technical and cultural. So what we believe is that we need new approaches entirely. Not only do we need new computational approaches to annotation and, sort of manipulation and that kind of thing. But we really do need to do it in a way that is simultaneously useful and usable to scientists and the end users. Well, that almost goes without saying, but we believe that the metadata problem can only be solved by an end-to-end solution that includes not only the creation of the templates and ways to fill out those templates with ontology-based terms and archiving the metadata, suggesting and implementing enhancements, you know, those kinds of things that we think of very commonly and the ability to find, explore, and reuse these data sets. But we believe that a crucial aspect of this that is actually somewhat innovative and unique is in a more holistic and dynamic approach using an ecosystem approach where the specific work is done in collaboration with the end users at all stages of those aspects, of those components. So we specifically will work with communities of actual investigators to standardize the descriptions of the studies that we do. We have we're still focusing on initially on laboratory experiments. We've got three different sets of users that we're going to focus on to start with, import, users of import, which is immunology repository, Stanford data repository, which is full across all of Stanford and fully supported by the Dean of Research and lives at the library in Stanford, and as well the NIH data centers. We expect this computational ecosystem to be cyclical in the development, the evaluation, the use, and the refinement of the metadata templates and other tools, engaging the biomedical community at all stages, not just waiting until we're done with it and training them how to use it and, you know, banging on their heads until they do, but make them part of the life cycle, part of the ecosystem, so that we can have reiterative evaluation. Evaluation is something that I'm pretty keen on. Given, I think, anybody that's pragmatic and wants to have something operational, formative evaluation as well as summative evaluation is a key part of your development cycle. The ability to, I think several people have said it, to embrace failure. And I'm not saying that we want to fail, but we want to learn from our failures and be able to take those things. Why didn't that work? Not just it didn't work, but why didn't it work, and how can we use it to build something better? And I would say, you know, as usual and as should be expected, I would hope would be expected, everything will be open, public, and reiterative, available to both the community researchers as well as the community of the folks here who specialize in the tasks of the work that we're trying to build.
My name is Frank Olkin. I'm a program director here at the National Science Foundation in the Computing Directorate. In particular, I'm part of the IIS division and the III cluster. I came to semantic technologies and ontologies originally because of my I was working in statistical databases, and I came to realize at one point we were looking at disease epidemiological data because at one time DOE was interested in health impacts of energy technologies, and I happened to be looking at HIV incidence data. And I realized that you couldn't do anything with the first 5 years of HIV incidence data because the Centers for Disease Control kept changing the definition, not for whimsical reasons, but because in the early years they didn't understand it very well, and they kept tinkering with the definition until they settled on something that they thought captured the salient points. And this was sort of this was the first time I'd really thought in detail about semantics, and I came to realize that if the classification schemes for diseases were not stable and well understood, and the same across the different jurisdictions that were collecting the data, that this data wasn't going to be comparable, and you wouldn't be able to do any analysis on it. And so I gradually got more interested in semantics. I wound up working on RDF schema standards, schema language standards, a bunch of XML stuff, and in particular on the ISO 11179 metadata registry standard with Gail, who's in the back of the room there, and various other folks, originally with EPA support. And we, over the course of the better part of a decade, we actually managed to put some notions of ontologies into the ISO 11179 standard was a metadata registry standard, and it was basically had come out of terminology standards. And we wanted to put some more ontological concepts in it. And there was initially fairly considerable resistance to this. But in any case, I'm now at NSF. NSF does support work in semantics and ontologies. It's split. It's mostly in the computing directorate, but it's split among different groups. III, which primarily supports data management and information retrieval and data mining, various things like this, does support knowledge representation work. We support work in description logics. We support work in ontology development tools, other sorts of things like this. There's also more exotic logics, modal logics, answer set programming, other things like this, non-monotonic logics are handled primarily in another cluster called Robust Intelligence, basically the AI group. And there is the what used to be the Office of Cyber Infrastructure is now the Advanced Cyber Infrastructure Division. Dr. Jahanian referred to they have a program called DIBS, Data Infrastructure Building Blocks, I think it's called, run by Amy Walton and some other folks. And they support a little further down the development cycle. They expect that you have running software that people can use across various scientific domains at the end of an award, a 3 or 4 year award. And the DIBS solicitation just closed for this year, and they're preparing to run panels in May, end of May. We have a SIES has a solicitation on the street known as something like Critical Technologies for Big Data. And this is addressed primarily at basic technologies for big data, data management, data mining, and ontologies and semantic technologies for big data. And that closes on June 9th. And we're trying to process those awards in the current fiscal year, which will be challenging. If people have additional questions about where to go to get funding for particular aspects of semantic technologies and ontologies, I'm here after the session. I would note that SIES is a computer science research directorate, so it's primarily focused on tool development, technologies, logics, things like this. We don't particularly support content development. So if you come and say, I want to do an ontology on, let's say, infectious diseases, we would gently suggest that perhaps you should go talk to NIH. We do some support of healthcare IT technologies in a program called Smart and Connected Health, and there they support work, for example, on summarization of electronic health records and the like. I could talk about particular issues in ontologies and big data. Maybe we'll do that in response to the questions, but let me simply start by one subject which some of you may recognize that I've been somewhat obsessed with over the last decade, and that is the state of recording units of measure for data and correspondingly dimensional considerations for at the ontology level. It's largely absent in many systems or done somewhat haphazardly, and I am a strong proponent that dimensional analysis should be taught in all data modeling courses and ontology courses. And we have yet to have an agreed standard for ontologies for units of measure, which would be really nice if NIST would pursue this. And I think that that's a subtle hint.
I didn't think it was so subtle.
But there are other issues as well, fundamental issues. I think that if you look at the data science curriculum that are being developed, the ones I've seen tend to be relatively weak on formal semantics and data modeling and ontology issues, and they could certainly I think that all data science curricula, particularly at the graduate level, should include a course in formal semantics of data, and I'm rather surprised that they don't. And I think that CS curricula should include a logic course as a requirement for graduation. It's rather amazing that you can get a bachelor's degree without taking a course in logic. Now, when I got my degree in EECS from Berkeley, I had a course in logic. Unfortunately, it was about Carnot map minimization. It was not very useful for knowledge representation. And curiously, it's not a requirement even to graduate with a doctorate in data management or computer science to have either any formal logic or knowledge representation. And I regard this as somewhat amazing. And in 2014, I think it's sort of inexcusable. We have other problems as well. The logics that we're using typically do not have a lot of support for arithmetic. And as you go into domains like finance or physics or other things like this, they don't really have the expressivity that you would like to see. So I think I will stop at this point and answer questions.
6 minutes since the last 2 days, and John got okay, better? All right. So apologies for my voice being a bit hoarse. I'll try to keep it short, and I'll actually take up on some of the hints that you were talking about. So just a brief introduction. I'm the chief of the Information Access Division at NIST, Ram Sriram Spear. My division is about 100 staff plus contractors, and our focus is on the data-to-knowledge pathway, which is when you have raw data, how do you measure the data analytics process going into the system, and how do you measure the efficacy of the data analytics components along the complex workflows? So one of my, just as an example, the TREC conference for search and retrieval, some of you know about it. We have been running that. One of my groups focuses on TREC, and we have been doing that for the last 20 years. Then we have one group that focuses on image-based analytics, one group focusing on speech, and then TREC has spawned another conference called TREC-VID, which focuses on video-based analytics. Then we have one program on speech recognition, machine translation, and then one last group that focuses on human-computer interaction, so measuring the usability of systems. How do you make technology systems much more usable by humans? So you can have the best of technologies, but if you can't make it usable by a human, it's not going to be useful. It's not going to be adopted. So we have come to a point, as many of you noted, where now we're converging on different data types, and the field of data science is obviously being adopted in educational curriculum. So in March, we actually had a kickoff data science symposium series, and the objective is to actually now start a new program in data science, whether it's big data science or small data science. Obviously, I personally like the term data science better than big data, but I think it depends on which perspective you're coming from. And the objective is, in data science, you now are encountering increasingly heterogeneous data modalities. So you have different data types coming in, which provide more and more rich information about the same event, the same source of data. And if you are able to effectively merge these heterogeneous data types, let's say text combined with structured data, combined with speech and video, then the power of your derived knowledge improves dramatically. But now with these heterogeneous data analytics workflows being more and more complex, being able to break down the process of the analytics and being able to measure, let's say, the error propagation as it goes through the complex analytic workflow is a big deal. And it's largely an unknown. So our objective is, for example, to try to come up with some foundational advances in data science by creating some challenge tasks which cross domains, which cross different domains. And obviously, you know, and ontologies is a big thing. So as you said, I mean, one challenge is in deriving the knowledge from data, but also the metadata itself, being able to find correspondences between metadata, which have different representations across different communities, is a big challenge. So we recognize that in the data science program, ontologies or using ontologies in the data analytic process is actually a challenging step. And we are hoping to engage with a lot of the experts in the ontology space in the data science program. In fact, tomorrow we have the first public working group, the evaluation working group for data science, for the NIST data science program. So if any of you are interested, I'll be happy to send that across to you. So with that said, and my horse wise, I will, you know, I'll stop right here. And, you know, I welcome questions to any of the panelists, I guess.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Chief. So now we'll begin the kind of the discussion questions as ways of initiating some discussions. So the first question is, what do you think are the biggest opportunities for applying ontologies to semantic web and big data problems? I guess we'll kind of keep the maybe the same order, or I can just pick people at random. Tim, do you want to start off? Thanks.
Well, not surprisingly, I thought the two biggest opportunities were the things we were working on in our lab. But I've convinced myself it's true. You know, one of them is working with language, information extracted from language. So language technology's really come a long way in the last 10 years. It's pretty good, and it's just getting better. And this is extracting information both from speech and from text. And it could be to extract facts from speech and text, or it could be for interfaces. We're getting more and more automated systems, robots, home automation, and, you know, we want to be able to interact with them in natural modalities like speech. So I think it's a great opportunity because, in my mind, the semantics in the semantic web or any knowledge representation system has to do with meaning that's in human heads. You know, whether it's formal or kind of a more natural. And so, you know, language is all about that also. And, you know, we need to have a good knowledge representation target to put that information into. And I think we've got that with semantic web technology. You know, for my money, I think, you know, OWL right now, for better or for worse, is the only broadly used, you know, knowledge representation language. There used to be, you know, lots of them, but OWL's the only one now, and it's not going to be the only one forever. It'll be replaced with something else, but that's what everybody's using, except for, you know, one-offs here and there. The other area, besides the language technology, which is a, you know, good opportunity for us to, you know, be a part of that, is cybersecurity, and that's mostly because, you know, it's a big concern. A lot of people are interested in funding research to help us improve cybersecurity. And I think cybersecurity is an area where you've got a lot of data. If you're trying to protect the network for an organization, data from the network, data from all the devices in the network, data from all the hosts. And, you know, there's a lot of machine learning applied to it to try to extract more data, and you need to sort of do something with that. And we really don't have good models, semantic models or even, you know, for a lot of the stuff that we need to represent, processes, software, versions, and things. And so I think if we can develop some good semantic models for cybersecurity, concepts that are important for cybersecurity, then they'll be a good match, and we can do our part to help secure systems. That's sort of my thought on what's good opportunities for these technologies.
Thank you, Tim. Mark.
I decided not to take Tim's easy way out. Say what I work on is the biggest opportunity. I actually found every question that he's posed very difficult to respond to because it required that I figure out what the question really meant. Part of my problem is I teach a course on big data and global cities, and so deal with the issue of doing data analytics on urban data, and I find that very, very frustrating. So the approach I've taken to answering this question is to create a taxonomy of problems, in a sense. And if I wasn't into ontologies, well, if you are into ontologies, you tend to taxonomize anything that you face. So the first thing is the issue of data source that we run into. Is it single source or multi-source data? I'm not even dealing with modalities here, but if you go and you look at a lot of the big data applications that are touted around the world, we're dealing with single source data, whether it's recommendation systems that deal with market basket information or dealing with credit applications. You're basically dealing with a single source of information to make those types of predictions. And that makes data analytics a whole lot easier than when you're dealing with multi-source data that's coming from a variety of locations. Let me give you two examples of multi-source data that you would think would be trivial, but is not. The most trivial one I have is the 311 data. If you go to all of the cities that have 311 capabilities, you will find that they put their data online because of the open source, open data initiatives. But when you go and you look at the data from each of these cities, the file structures are different, the attribute names are different, and the content is different. And one of the things that we tend to forget when we talk about data is the actual content itself, okay? If we're talking about geodata, you know, latitude, longitude, okay, that's really easy to talk about in terms of content. It's a number, okay? But if you talk about 311 calls, and there's approximately 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 types of problems that are being reported, then the actual content of the attribute that represents the call is important if you want to do any type of analysis. And if there's no standardization of what that content is, you have a real problem if you want to do anything with that data. So even trying to bring together data from multiple, actually even within one city's 311 data, you'll find a lot of variation in the content itself. There's no standardization. When you compare between cities, there's no standardization on structure of the data, the attribute names of the data, and the actual content. And in many cases, there's not a one-to-one mapping. And that makes doing any type of data analytics that's transversal, that is cross-city, very, very difficult to do. Now, let me give you another example. One of the teams in my course wanted to look at being able to predict the SAT performance of students at high schools within New York City, okay? And they wanted to use things like census data, income, things of that nature. They want to use data around crimes in the area, and there was other data, et cetera, that they wanted to use. The trouble was that the police precincts is a different geographic area than the census area, which is different than the school area. So if you're trying to do any type of merging of this data, you have a very basic problem. Just having the geocoding of it is not sufficient because they don't, one doesn't encompass the other, they overlap in a variety of ways, and it's very difficult to infer how one piece of data can be applied against another piece of data across another piece of data. And so the whole issue of doing data analytics with respect to urban data of this type becomes a real challenge. And quite frankly, I had 10 teams doing urban data analytics projects, and each team failed, okay? Because in the period of time of about 2 months working on this, there was not enough time to get the data right. And I'm not even talking about the analytics. I mean, the easy part is running an analytics engine on it. The hard part is getting the data right, okay? And that's what we ran into time and time again. So that's a data source, single source versus multi-source. Another dimension that one has to deal with when you're dealing with urban data or data in general, big data, is the ontology components that are there, terminology versus axiomatization. Are we talking about ontologies are strictly terminology or vocabulary, or are we talking about ontologies that actually have some type of axiomatization? And minimally axiomatization could simply be the properties you associate with the class of owl. Maximally, it can be an arbitrary logic expression, be it first order, whatever other logic that you want to have. And when we're talking about ontologies, we all have a different view of which one we're talking about. If you talk to Mike and I, we're talking about full axiomatization. Those are the ontologies we want to talk about. Talk to somebody else at schema.org, and it's simply a vocabulary, and it's a fairly sparse vocabulary at that. Third dimension you got to deal with. You got to deal with domain legacy, okay? If we're going to ask the question, what are our opportunities, we have to look at the legacy of formalization of terminology that exists within the domain you're dealing with. I'd be happy to be in Carol's area where there's a history of research in what are the standard names for diseases, for drugs, for bacteria, for, I mean, there's a history of hundreds of years of trying to get this right. I walk into a city situation, we don't have a history of a day of trying to get it right, let alone hundreds of years. All the knowledge is all over the place. And the beautiful thing about it all, there's a huge amount of politics. I am working with the City of Toronto in trying to develop an ontology for city services. And so we get the current ontology, I wouldn't want to call it ontology, but the vocabulary that they currently use. It has no rhyme or reason. There's no semantics associated with it. It's totally ambiguous. I can't understand it. When we come back and say, okay, here's a better structuring of that vocabulary, they come back to us and say, well, this is the way we've been doing it. We don't want to change. I said, so why'd you knock on my door? Okay, so there are domains where there's no history of formalization of the content of the terminology, et cetera. And that itself is a major challenge, okay? And then we have another dimension, which is what's the nature of the analysis? And one of the things that we keep forgetting in our discussion, which I'm glad that Tim actually brought up, was there's a whole world out there indexing documents, okay, Google, Yahoo, et cetera, okay? That's big data. It's a type of big data, but we tend to ignore that. And we tend to focus in predictive analytics on non-indexing type data, which is segmentation, clustering, you know, that type of stuff. And so the question then becomes, what's the dimension along which we are looking at in terms of the nature of the analysis we want to perform? So that's another one that I have to. And so those are the dimensions I think about when I think about where do our opportunities lie. Well, the opportunities are everywhere. The question is, how difficult is the opportunity that I'm facing versus one that Tim is facing versus what Google is facing, et cetera. And so let me end by just talking a bit about the issues that I'm facing in one area of research that I perform in the urban domain. And this has to do with city performance. I'm involved in a project called Global City Indicators, okay? If you listen to my the Ontology Summit speech before, if you were there, then you've already heard this, but I'll repeat it again. The World Bank in 2008 asked the University of Toronto to determine what global city indicators, that is, ways of measuring city performance exist. We looked at nine cities. I was not involved in it. They looked at nine cities across North and South America. From those nine cities, they identified over 1,000 city indicators that were being used. Of those city indicators, only two of them were comparable. So if you ever look at comparisons of cities across the world, they're total bullshit, okay, absolute and utter bullshit, okay, because they don't operate with the same definitions as to what city metrics are. Today in 2014, the Global Cities Institute at University of Toronto has received approval for an ISO standard on about 125 global city indicators that's already being adopted by about 250 cities around the world, including cities in the U.S., Canada, China, you name it. So there's been huge movement forward. But these definitions are on paper and subject to interpretation by the reader. And I guarantee you, when somebody in Japan reads it, they're going to read something totally different than somebody in North America versus China versus elsewhere. And so my research focuses on, and this is really key, this is really what, to me, ontologies are all about, is how do I represent those definitions in an ontology, okay? How can I precisely characterize the definition of a student-teacher ratio all the way down to where am I measuring a population of a student, how am I characterizing what a student is, so that when I'm going to do analysis, I know that this difference of change in the student-teacher ratio in the year 1990 in the city of Toronto and the student-teacher ratio in 2010 is due to the fact that there was a merger of cities in Toronto in 1998, and hence the geographic boundaries of that city changed dramatically. Okay? That's really the representation, the ontology is heterogeneous, analytical formulae, classic knowledge representation type representations of what student is, spatial reasoning, temporal reasoning, temporal representation space, the whole gamut of things in order to figure out that there's what the root causes of difference, what the root causes of the difference. And so there are the big opportunity that I see within the urban world, one of the big opportunities for the very first time is to be able to represent our definitions of things in a computational manner. And then on top of that, be able to begin automating the analysis of that information in ways that couldn't be done before. Simple analysis can be consistency checks. Is the city where I measured the number of students the same city as I measured the number of teachers? Are those the same? Is the city that in 1990 the same city as the city in 2010? These are all consistency axioms that look at different pieces of the representations to make sure they're consistent. And then there's the automation of the analysis itself, what the root cause is. And to me, this is what ontologies are all about. It's the precise representation of the meanings of these things, so I can then go to the next step, which is to automate some portion of that analysis to truly get at the root cause of why it is, why things are the way they are.
Thanks, Mark. Carol, what do you think are the biggest opportunities?
What they said? I think we've been told over the past couple of days, particularly by some of our keynote speakers, some very specific opportunities that we can almost immediately begin to address. I think, along with those comes the possibility of funding, which is always a nice thing, particularly in this activity. So data provenance, data persistence, data discovery, these are things that they've talked about emphasizing data integration. All of this, they admit, we know it requires ontology. So sometimes, sort of shifting focus to at least include these kinds of things and coming, again, from the government world, making sure that your work answers the questions that the funding agencies are answering or answers the questions the funding agencies are asking sometimes is probably a reasonable approach for some outcomes. I would argue that some of the things that didn't get mentioned but would also be included were within the context of opportunities are dealing with data quality, dealing with data transformation, and dealing with data portability. Particularly, this is from my, I think it probably transcends domains, but in my context in the biomedical world, those are things that have particular significance. And frankly, algorithms for managing big data are useless unless you can find it in the first place and know how to interpret it. So, that's kind of the simple side of things. I would, so one of my obvious, taking the note from Tim, is metadata, some of the, and I think we each tend to choose problems that we think are important and also can handle. I think there are some other opportunities, at least, again, from my perspective in the biomedical arena, with the types of data that we have that require, I would say, extreme levels of privacy and confidentiality of the data themselves and ways to anonymize the data, which for many types of data we don't need to do. But in order to work with it, we've got to be able to do that. I think some of that applies also to business data. Because of the proprietary nature of things. So I would think that privacy, confidentiality, anonymization of data and ways that we can still work with it would be an opportunity. I don't have quick answers for those kinds of things. And I think that's the three items that I would identify as opportunities to apply ontology to semantic web and big data. I would like to comment on your comment, Mark. Yes, we do have a lot of formal work in ontologies and vocabularies in the biomedical world, but little agreement. So the more we have, the less agreement we have. The other thing that we have found, particularly lately, over the last couple of years, and I don't think I need to go into too much detail, is it's become highly politicized. And that is an area, or that is a factor that has made it particularly difficult to work in. And I speak both from on the side where, you know, politics is within the domain, and on the other side where anything dealing,
data
definition and what we do with them and all of the things that we're talking about, you know, provenance, persistence, all of these issues have become highly politicized. It's not just the people that work with them having the religious wars over the thing, but it's now become a political battleground in some cases. And I don't know how to handle that, but I think it's a factor that we all need to, if we're looking at, I think our environment right now is more politicized than it used to be, and we need to be careful about casting and framing things in ways that draw interest and not bullets. So.
Thanks, Carol. Frank.
Okay. So somewhat reflecting my background, I think that one of the big opportunities is for, in terms of more systematic approaches to data integration of heterogeneous data sets, which exist in abundance in big data, particularly in social science data, as Mark alluded to, which I've been interested in for a long time. And let me just mention a couple of kinds of heterogeneity that we see that are not always recognized. So, for example, in the case of the EPA, they collect various statistics on pollution levels, and often these are reported in parts per million. And you think, oh, this is a dimensionless quantity. This gets rid of the units question, until you stop and think for a minute and ask the question, well, was this a ratio of masses, a ratio of volumes, a ratio of partial pressures, if they're gases, or a ratio of moles? And I have never seen any annotations on this data. After considerable empirical investigations, it seems that most of the time these are mass ratios. But who knows? And, of course, if you want to convert them from one to another, you typically require knowing things like the molecular weight of the compounds involved, maybe the pressure and temperature. It can be completely baffling to understand what these things mean unless they're very carefully annotated, which they usually aren't. In the case of the EPA, they have very elaborate testing protocols that tell you exactly how you measure these concentrations of particular chemical compounds, and they say, you take this sample and you do the following chemical treatments and measurements and stuff like this. You have the same problem in medical measurements, and my impression is that the standardization, not only does the EPA standardize how you test for these things, they actually run calibration studies where they send out calibrated samples to record how well the labs are doing. These are water treatment quality labs. The same problems arise in medical testing, and my impression is that the standardization is not nearly as complete as it is in the case of the EPA yet. So there is the question, if you get samples from two different labs, are you actually seeing the same thing measured? Simple medical measurements, like if you're taking blood pressure measurements, was the patient standing or sitting? And how long had he been sitting since he last was doing some exercise or something like this? Or is the patient lying down? Most charts don't record this information. And sometimes they're very careful about doing this, and sometimes they're not. In the case of one of my favorite ones is unemployment statistics. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes 6 different time series on unemployment in the United States. And they measure, you know, some of them are the person has some job or the person has got a full-time job and other things. They're U1 through U6. I think the one that's normally reported is U2 or something like this. But in any case, U6 is much bigger than U1. And it turns out for international comparisons, unemployment is defined differently in different countries, and international comparisons of unemployment are fraught with difficulties. But apropos this question of the politicization, which Carol alluded to, I'll point to 2 examples. First of all, for social data, there may be no escape from this because these are social constructs. So I'll give 2 examples. One is the poverty rate in the United States. The definition of a poor person in the United States was defined, I think, in something like 1965, and a family was considered poor if their income was below 4 times the level required to feed a family of 4 on a minimal diet. No accounting of housing costs, no accounting of medical costs, transportation costs, anything. This was a crude approximation developed in the War on Poverty early in the Johnson administration. It has subsequently been cast into various funding formulas in federal legislation. So there is enormous reluctance to tamper with this definition, and yet it is widely recognized that it is a very crude approximation. And for those of you who care about these things, there's an annual conference called the Association of Public Data Users that's held here in Washington once a year in September, where representatives of the various federal statistical agencies and the users of federal data come and talk about these sorts of things. And some of the discussions are quite fascinating. There are ongoing efforts to change at least the definition used for statistical purposes of poverty, but as Carol alluded to, since this is a major social indicator, it's extremely controversial. And the work that's been going on, they've had to say, well, we'll use this as a statistical indicator, but we won't use it to change the funding allocations. Even so, it's run into problems. And another example is, what is a wetland? Gail will recognize this. The EPA has, I think, 7 different definitions of wetlands, which stem from 7 different pieces of legislation that govern their authority. And whether something is considered a wetland or not affects whether or not the EPA can regulate what you dump in it or whether you fill it. And so there are court cases over this. There's continuing litigation over this, actually. And the point that I try to make to data modelers is if the statistics you're doing have any social significance whatsoever, then no one is going to let computer scientists write the definitions. These definitions are written by regulators and legislators and courts, and you just have to take them as given, and you have to understand the context because, as I said, in the case of the EPA, there are 7 different definitions of a wetland. So if you want to ask what's the total wetlands in the United States, it depends on in what context you're asking that question. And this is
you're the ones that have to study logic in college, not us.
people who are particularly people designing databases think, well, I'll sit here, I'll invent a bunch of attributes, I'll name them, and then I'll write the definitions of it. And you don't get to write the definitions. If you want to ask what is income, for example, the IRS defines income, and then the courts, people litigate it, and the courts have definitions of what is income and what are losses and things like this. It's not a bunch of computer scientists or ontologists that get to make up these definitions. We can try and clean them up, but these things have significant political and economic consequences, and we don't get to define them. We can suggest to people how to do them, but not. In other areas, like in medicine, it's more of a scientific question, although even there, because it affects payments, the definition of what is a disease or a condition is increasingly politicized, and we know that medical service providers are tinkering with the reporting codes that they're using in order to try to increase the funding that they get. And so if you see an upsurge in the severity of, let's say, some kind of disease, for example, respiratory diseases, the question is, are you looking at real data, or are you looking at someone trying to manipulate the funding process? I don't know what to say about, but I do know that a corollary of this is I firmly believe that all definitions used in ontologies and database schemas and the like need footnotes that cite the governing authority for the definition. And it's not usually an ontologist. It's usually a court or a regulator or an agency or something like this. So this is one of the things that we need to do, but much of the stuff that NSF is concerned with is actually is scientific data, where these things are not quite as prominent. But to give an example, when we're looking at temperature records, the question becomes, and we're looking at time series of temperatures, well, you're measuring the temperature at a location, but people have been building buildings around this location, and they've been cutting down trees, and they've been doing other things. And the question is, are we really measuring the same temperature over time? We have this problem with satellites as well. So you need pretty careful characterization, and the question is, do we have formal mechanisms for specifying these definitions? And the answer is, in many cases, no. I mean, we can capture some of the data, but the elaborate definition of what's an unemployed person or what the actual context of a testing procedure was, we don't have that formal specification yet. One of the areas that I've been particularly interested in that we have no ontologies whatsoever, as far as I know, is we don't have good ontologies for survey designs. The census uses fairly exotic, complex sampling designs for doing surveys. And the definition of these things is written in English text at the moment. And the estimators are hand-constructed in most cases. You would like to have formal definitions of these things, and you'd like to be able to build reasoning agents that could construct a statistical estimator given the definition of the sample. But we don't have this yet. And it's an obstacle to fully automated statistical analysis.
Okay. Thanks, Ray. Ashit, do you have any thoughts on some of the big opportunities?
And we have gone through the first question. Yes. So I'll take a shot at answering the first and the second, which I think are kind of related. So you talked about biggest opportunities and then the lowest hanging fruit. So in my mind, echoing some of the other panelists, the biggest opportunities are in the fields where there's a rich history of documenting processes, materials, experiments, and that really results in building a rich database of ontologies that can be used and reused. So in my mind, the traditional sciences are actually the biggest beneficiaries of ontology. So material science, physical sciences, medical science, and biological sciences. So I think the richest and the lowest hanging fruit and the highest impact is probably in the medical science domain because of two reasons. So one is if you use traditional text-based processing, NLP, search and retrieval, the variety of languages, terminologies, taxonomies used in the medical domain are varied even within the same hospital. We've talked to people from the doctors from the VA, and within two hospitals in the VA, they use different ontologies for the same disease, or the same class of diseases. So in my mind, that speaks to the complexity of the problem. And traditional LLP tools by themselves will really have, or already have a very challenging time dealing with these. So the example I'll give is that I was talking to a colleague at one of the universities in California, and they've done an analysis of how analytics works just by using NLP on a medical record versus combining NLP techniques with ontologies, taxonomies, and semantics. And they showed a 33% improvement in classification rights by combining the ontologies with the traditional NLP-based analytic process. So that really speaks to the power of ontologies in the space. So I think ontologies has a lot of opportunities, but it really has the best opportunities in the areas where traditional techniques, analytic techniques will fail. One new area where I've noticed ontologies are being used is in tech support. So, you know, tech support now, you have this, even though it's a very new field, the collection of calls and complaints is very automatic. So now, even in a matter of a few years, in these tech support call centers, you have a rich collection of taxonomies and ontologies. And now I've seen that the tech support industry is using ontologies as a way to quickly or more quickly come to a solution for the customers. So, you know, I'll leave it there. I think ontologies have a higher impact in certain segments where you have a richer database of ontologies and dictionary of ontologies.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so the second question was kind of like asking if there are any of these kind of low-hanging fruit, or is it really just a question of doing some hard work? And if so, then what is that work that needs to be done by the community? So what do we need to be kind of focusing on? Tim?
Well, two things came to my mind. One is that I think there's a big opportunity that's sort of focused on the, more on the vocabulary end of things, like linked open data, schema.org. There are a lot of people out there who don't, who haven't drunk the ontology Kool-Aid maybe, but who see the value in those resources if they can be leveraged for various purposes. So I think one low-hanging fruit would be to sort of mine that end of our activities. And again, going back to the domains, to my knowledge, there are no good ontologies for describing what's going on inside our computational systems. You know, processes, ports, connections, networks, software versions. You've got Adobe Acrobat, you've got Adobe Acrobat version 10, you've got Adobe Acrobat version 10.1.2, you know, patch level 4. And sometimes those things make a difference. It seems like it's a case of Shoemaker's children, maybe, that we don't have good. But that domain is becoming more important to us because we have to manage all this software and we have to protect it, make it secure, keep people from hacking into it. So I think that's a domain where, we could use some good ontologies. And if some are provided, especially if they're on, you know, not just the highly axiomatized complex ones, but some simple ones, they could have an impact. We could get our foot in the door for this area.
I agree with Tim wholeheartedly. The low-hanging fruit has already been grabbed by schema.org, and you can't get anything lower than that. So the other half of the question is what additional work needs to be done, and I think this plays off of what our speaker this morning, our invited speaker, referred to about the popularity of ontologies and understanding of it. I was recently asked by a research lab in Singapore to provide them some readings on ontologies because we're doing a project together, and they don't have an ontology background. So I started looking for some nice introductory material on an ontology and methods for building ontologies, you know, something that really brings it together nicely. And I used my favorite search tool, Google, and I didn't end stop after one or two items on one page. I went to page three. I went to page four. I couldn't find anything. I found a number of articles, and they're good, and they're, you know, and the standard ones that are out there, but, you know, they're somewhat dated, and they're also represent a particular view. And so if I try and give one article to somebody that says, here's a basic introduction to what ontologies are all about, so you, the unwashed, can figure out what it is that we're talking about, I couldn't find it. And so I believe that this community has done a disservice to itself by not making it easy for the rest of the world to understand what it is that we do. And we have to change that if we want ontologies to have an impact. Because if we don't change it, then schema.org will be the impact, okay? And we will be left on the roadside. Now, I started looking to see if there's anything that could be used. And I, you know, the Open Ontology Repository, when I read the homepage of the OOR, it has many of the same ideas as to what needs to be accomplished, except it doesn't appear to have executed on the vision. And so while we have a vehicle that we could pursue this with, we have yet to pursue the creation of the ontology definition, the tutorial on what ontology is. We don't have good repositories. We talk about having good repositories. We talk about all these things, but we don't really have good ones. And until I can feel comfortable giving somebody a pointer, a URL, or a PDF file that truly gives them a good introduction to what ontologies are, what ontology engineering is, what is a good repository that describes the various ontologies and why I would want to use them, I think that is the additional work that we need to do. Because we spend all our time creating ontologies. I mean, it's so much fun creating ontologies. And Frank is always asking about measurement ontologies. There's at least a, you know, half dozen or more measurement ontologies. I have my favorite measurement ontology that I use. But what's the point of creating the ontologies if nobody knows what they are, nobody knows how to find it, nobody knows how to measure whether it's appropriate for my particular task, and it's all the questions that we keep asking year after year after year. And until we solve that, you know, what's the point?
I don't have a lot to add, so I will pass.
I just wanted to mention one additional point, and that is that the programming language community has done an enormous amount of work on type theory and type systems, and this has been largely ignored by the database community, and not as much, but also a fair amount by the ontology community. And I think that we could profit from more of a synthesis between these two research areas. In terms of low-hanging fruit, in addition to the biomedical applications, I would also point to the finance applications, which Mike Bennett is working on and other folks. There's enormous interest of late in the financial regulatory community in trying to automate the processing of financial data and get more comparable data and better, more transparent understanding of what's happening in the financial sector. And I think this will drive a lot of interest in ontologies. As I said, part of the problem is that the logics we have don't do a good job of dealing with arithmetic and other kinds of mathematical constructs. But the SEC, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department are all intensely interested in this kind of data. And it, how shall I say this? Saying that it moves markets is an understatement. I mean, we just came out of this 2008 financial collapse, and I've heard assistant secretaries of Treasury talk about it, and they were basically flying blind as they went into this. And they feel that, you know, if they're going to respond to these kinds of events, they need this kind of data, and they need comparable data. And, you know, we don't, we're just barely getting to the point of getting standardized identifiers for mortgages, much less standard definitions of these things. And a mortgage these days is, I don't know, 100 or 200 pages of legal text. It's not a simple, you know, 12 parameters. So you and I think of a mortgage as a down payment and an interest rate and maybe points or something like this, but they're much more complicated than this. So those are two that I would point to. And the biomedical applications, simply because healthcare is now 18%, I think, of the U.S. GDP. It's more than a sixth of GDP, and so it's like $2 trillion a year or something like this. And there's great people are doing repeating tests because they don't have access to the medical records. And there's a great deal of concern that in theory, better IT could lead to better treatment, and possibly more efficient treatment.
Wider way of describing this would be that ontologies have the potential to increase the accessibility of data in databases. So if you have rich enough ontologies that describe the data of the databases, then the data sets and the data themselves become more accessible to the users, become more usable to the users. And then also on the flip side, they actually become more machine readable. So if you have good metadata descriptors with a rich backend of ontologies, then there's a better chance that data sets can be more interoperable with each other, that data sets can be more sort of machine readable, and that makes automated processing and access a lot more easier. So that extends to the financial areas that you pointed out, the medical areas, and other areas that are emerging, actually.
So I just want to we didn't get through all the questions. So the questions that we didn't get through, I'd invite the different panelists maybe to, if you have some notes about them, to send them to me, and we can post them onto the wiki page. But just before we finish, I would really like to get people's opinions on question three about any key features or requirements of semantic web and big data applications that the applied ontology community are perhaps either ignoring or downplaying. Again, I mentioned it earlier today about some of our potential blind spots. So just a few words on that, and we can wrap up the panel with that. So, Tim, what do you think? Are there any things that we're ignoring or
things
like that?
Yeah, I think noise statistics, probability, these sorts of things. We've got a lot of big data. It's probably going to be noisy. If you put it into a semantic web framework, then, you know, you're going to get inconsistencies. We need some way of also dealing with distributions and noise and probabilities, some tools.
Mm. Mark, what are we ignoring or discounting?
I didn't have a very good answer to that question, because I worry about the measurement ontologies, I worry about the statistics aspects of that, et cetera, et cetera, in the work that I do. So the big issue is, number one, I don't have very good tools for merging ontologies. I don't have any tools whatsoever to do reasoning with ontologies. When I think about reasoning, I'm not thinking about whether something is subsumed by something else. Okay, I really want to do some reasoning. And, yeah, I can load my ontology up in the Prolog if I output it as RDF XML. And at that point, I then have to write all my own Prolog axioms that figure out the syntax of the whole thing. I mean, I don't have any good tools to actually do some real reasoning applications with all these ontologies. So the ontologies end up to be this data structure and nothing more than that, even though we have all these axioms. And so I really want to get at the reasoning side of things. I want to do more than just identifying inconsistencies or subsumption. I mean, that's just not very – it doesn't fly my kite or whatever the appropriate term is. The other thing that I wanted to mention besides tools is this whole issue of competency, okay? I have no idea what these ontologies are good for. I mean, there's vocabularies out there. There's ontologies fully axiomatized. There's 5 or 10 variations of measurement ontologies. I have no idea what they're good for. I have to go read them. I look at an upper ontology. I have to go dig into the the actual definitions to see what this particular class means in sumo or some other upper-level ontology. And when I go and take a deep look at it, beyond the visualization that's available, I'm left wanting. There's almost nothing there that's of interest to me. And so why should I be forced to look deeply into the actual, you know, representation in OWL, RDF, whatever, protege to figure out what the meaning is? Somebody would have used COMPSI questions and come up with a full set of questions that this ontology was actually designed to answer. It would have saved me a whole lot of time. Okay? And so, you're right in some sense that there are going to be a lot of questions, but believe me, searching through a set of questions is a lot easier than searching through an ontology. Okay? And that may lead to something like, how do we infer questions from an ontology? How do we infer the COMPSI questions? Anyway, I have to say something controversial. But that's my big problem. I have no idea what these ontologies are good for. And you know, everybody and their kid, sister, brother, or whatever are publishing these vocabularies. And, you know, what's the point? Why should I look at it? I'm wasting my time on things that I shouldn't be wasting my time on. Okay.
Thanks, Mark. Carol.
Yeah, I do have a couple things on the being ignored and you know, ignored, downplayed kind of thing, and we'll wrap these into the things that I think are hindering us. It seems to me, just observationally, that semantic web stuff seems to be moving from the grand vision of intelligent agents and sort of solidifying around linked data. But the linked data is still only as good as the ontologies that are used. And we need better ways to describe the data that are being linked, but we also need, you know, ways to assure ourselves that the linked entities are the same, and also that the unlinked entities are not the same. So I think that there's work in both, but it seems to me that we're kind of shifting from one to the other. Why it disturbs me a little bit is that it seems like that we're shifting focus from the centrality of ontologies in creating and maintaining knowledge bases, you know, things that are knowledge-oriented, rather than just sort of linking pieces of creating, generating structures and knowledge itself. Lots of attention going to the use of ontologies for annotations and things, and that's sort of still up at that level of making the links and the connections. But I fear that we're really losing out on the opportunity and the promise of ontologies to build intelligent agents and artful things that, you know, go back for, you know, centuries and millennia, you know, to some extent. And I think some of that comes from, and I don't know if we're going to hit the last question, but I'll jump ahead to it, the differences in priorities and perspectives that are preventing collaborations are not so much what's preventing collaborations, but perhaps preventing, you know, some advance. And I think we tend, it's easy to focus on technology. It's relatively easy to focus on the technology. You know, and I think it's important to remember that big data is not Hadoop, that software is not semantic web is not RDF. And it may just be that we're ceding the discussion to the technologists rather than the true knowledge artists, I will call it, or the people that are really building those kinds of things. The third thing that I would mention is, while a lot of the religious discussions and religious arguments that we have around dogma and, you know, all of our favorite, you know, things that we do and the human sacrifices that we often have, and those are important, those are crucial discussions to have, but to outsiders, you know, outsiders of our closed little world, it looks like we don't know what we're talking about. We can't agree. They don't understand what we're talking about to begin with and why it makes a difference. And so I think that finding ways that we can come to common, you know, messages, common understanding, common appreciation, that messaging, you know, I think that was something also that Dan Kaufman talked about, is that it's important that we have a positive and consistent message about the importance of this stuff that is way beyond technology. So.
Thanks, Phil. Frank, a few brief words about any things that we're ignoring.
Yeah, just a few short remarks. One thing was this is only a problem in some kinds of big data, but DOE, NOAA, people doing oceanography are all engaged in efforts to model measurements or data over continuous domains, spatial domains. And yet the data management technologies we have and the ontology technologies are all typically built on discrete finite sets. And this is a very serious mismatch that's going to require serious work to fix. And we're seeing almost no proposals in this area. Very little work. There was some work on so-called fiber bundle data models that came out of 3D visualization efforts at TJ Watson. I don't know. I can't remember the name of the investigator. I think he's retired now. I know of only one proposal that I've seen recently that even begins to address issues of continuous data, continuous time, continuous spatial domains. And it's something we need to deal with, and we need formalized methods of doing it. And at the moment, all we have are very crude approximations. Yes, we have this mesh. Well, the mesh is not the reality. The mesh is just the data we have or the simulation data we have. So I would say this is one of the big areas that needs attention and really isn't getting much.
Thanks, Frank.
I think the biggest gap is actually the current space where there's no intersection between the big data analytics communities and the ontology communities. First of all, the ontology community is not very well aware of what's going on in the big data analytics community and vice versa. And even having forums, events where the two communities get to talk to each other, I think would really show the benefit of one approach versus the other, and how cross-collaboration would actually increase the power of what you get as an end knowledge base. I think that is the biggest gap. And designing ways to make or enhance this collaboration either through joint solicitations of some sort, which actually encourage a mix of ontologies with big data solutions, or having conferences where the two communities talk to each other. I think both are feasible solutions.
Okay, great. That's a good note to end on, because that's kind of what this summit was hopefully about, and hopefully some of those gaps are being addressed. So I'd like to, again, thank the panelists, Carol Bean, Tim Finan, Mark Fox, Frank Olken, Ashita Lukter, for a fantastic panel. And I'm sorry I didn't get through all the questions. But I say, if you have notes, send them to me, and we can put them on the wiki page. But thank you very much.